It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, diseases carried by ticks and mosquitoes are spreading faster now than in the past. We'll talk to an expert about what's happening and how you can safeguard yourself when you're outside. First, President Trump's longtime personal attorney, Michael Cohen, is getting national attention for his financial transactions with large payments from companies to his company, Essential Consultants. Several of Michael Cohen's client relationships have come into question in recent days. The most recently reported involved the pharmaceutical giant Novartis, which said it made $1.2 million in payments to the shell company controlled by Cohen. The stated reason for the payments was described by Novartis as a consulting contract on, quote, healthcare policy matters. Others, like AT&T and a firm tied to a Russian oligarch, made similar payments to the same shell company. That's the same company that made the $130,000 payment to adult film actress Stormy Daniels to ensure her silence about an affair she claimed to have with Donald Trump. Barbara McQuaid teaches at the University of Michigan Law School, was formerly U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. Barbara, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Before we dive into the details, is this a story of somebody close to the president cashing in on that perceived access? Not the first time that's happened in Washington, D.C., I assume. Or are there real potential legal implications of what's going on here?
The facts are really going to matter here. And, I'm sure that it's not Robert Mueller in this instance, but the Southern District of New York. I'm sure they're way ahead of us in terms of understanding all of the facts. You know, we've seen just a smattering of some of Michael Cohen's records that Michael Avenatti has provided, but it's likely that they have additional records, not only of money coming in, but where that money went. So if Michael Cohen is freelancing here and is just trying to cash in and isn't really doing anything in exchange for these payments, then maybe it's what we call crime, but not slime. Slime, but not crime. But it could be something more nefarious, and so they'll want to look at that. Is he lobbying on behalf of these organizations? And if so, has he registered as a lobbyist? The failure to do so can be prosecutable and punishable by up to 5 years in prison. Is he sharing these proceeds with anyone in the Trump administration, whether it's President Trump himself or other public officials, White House advisors and the like? Then there could be some problems. Are they making official acts in exchange for payments? Then it becomes something much more nefarious. So the facts will matter, but there's at least a red flag here that would cause prosecutors and investigators to want to inquire further.
Now, Michael Avenatti had revealed this information. It's been confirmed by some news outlets who have seen relevant documents. Avenatti's the attorney for Stormy Daniels in all of this. Questions have been raised about, well, why would he have this information? And there's suspicions that some of this stuff might have been illegally leaked to him or via someone else to him. How much are people worried about how this information got there?
Yeah, I really don't know how he got this information. It sounds like it has come from what is known as suspicious activity reports. These are reports that banks are required to file with the Treasury Department under laws that require them to know their customer. And so if they see transactions that look, you know, way more money than they ordinarily have coming in or going out or coming from unusual sources, they'll file these little suspicious activity reports with just a short narrative of what happened, and so that law enforcement then can access this database of suspicious activity reports if they're investigating people to see if these transactions provide information that might connect some dots about what they're looking at. And so it really is really only law enforcement who's supposed to have access to this, and it's law enforcement sensitive. It shouldn't be shared with others. And so if it was, there could be a problem there with someone leaking information. I really don't know how it happened. But as we said, this is really only sort of a starting point for investigators. That would trigger someone perhaps to issue a grand jury subpoena or execute a search warrant, as was done in this case, to try to get your arms around all of the documents to see all of the money going in and out of those bank accounts.
And you mentioned the idea of connecting the dots, and the attorney in this case has Avenatti has made the case, I think, that we're seeing some dots connected between the Stormy Daniels case and the payment from Michael Cohen's shell company, people have described it. And then one of these payments from companies affiliated with Victor Vexelberg, there's some connections there. The American company involved says, no, this had nothing to do with him. Now, he's a Russian wealthy person, an oligarch, people call him, tied to Vladimir Putin. So people are looking at this and saying, okay, is this a Russian connection via Michael Cohen using this shell company that Michael Cohen used to make payments on behalf of Donald Trump? I explained that in a really complicated way
no,
there.
I
is this something
the question.
People are watching for?
Sure, I think so. I mean, the emergence of this Russian oligarch making the payments, I think, likely raises some interest in are there connections here between what is referred to as the collusion investigation. But one thing that makes me think maybe not is the fact that the Justice Department spun this case off and handed it off to the Southern District of New York. There have been reports that Robert Mueller's team has interviewed the Russian oligarch in question here. And so it seems that they believe that it's unrelated at the moment anyway to that collusion investigation. Then that's why the Southern District of New York is kind of running with this investigation. And it's also being handled by their public integrity unit, which suggests that they do think it could relate to some sort of public corruption, bribery, extortion, and the like. But if they are able to put those pieces back together, it's all one Department of Justice, and they can certainly share any information they receive, including cooperation by Michael Cohen or anything else like that. They could share that back with Robert Mueller if they have information that relates to his core investigation.
Barbara McQuaid is with us from the University of Michigan Law School, former U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan, looking at Michael Cohen, new disclosures of payments to his shell company, the one that was used to pay Stormy Daniels, and trying to figure out what's going on with all of that. Now, Michael Avenatti, again, who represents Stormy Daniels, was asked on MSNBC's Morning Joe program yesterday if there's proof that Essential Consultants, that's Cohen's company, had made payments to other women apart from Daniels. Here's what he had to say.
I don't know yet whether this particular account connects mm-hmm. to other women, but what I will say is that this is an enormous amount of money
it is.
That is flowing into this account beginning in October, November, December time period of 2016. You've got millions of dollars that are being deposited into this account. Michael Cohen appears to be selling access to the President of the United States.
And you were touching on this a little earlier. I want to dig deeper into it. This idea of selling access to the president, that in and of itself, probably not illegal. What sorts of things would prosecutors, either Robert Mueller's team or in New York, be looking at to see, hey, this might be something illegal?
Yeah, as you said, if he's just sort of freelancing and holding himself out as I'm an expert on Donald Trump and I can tell you how he thinks, that's probably not illegal. But if he is lobbying with the administration on behalf of these organizations and has failed to register as a lobbyist, that could be a crime. So that would be one thing. If he is asking and conspiring with administration officials to take official acts in exchange for these payments, that could be bribery. If they are demanding payments from companies with business before the administration and threatening them that unless they pay, they won't get the access that they need to do their business, then that could be extortion. So these would be some of the crimes they're looking at. And I suppose to the extent that payments were made on the eve of the election to pay off people in the form of hush money, that could also be viewed through the lens of campaign finance violations. So number of crimes there. And then, anytime you're involving the flow of money through things, there could be bank fraud, wire fraud, mail fraud, could even be money laundering if you can show that the proceeds were from illegal activity. So, all of those statutes come into play when you start looking at financial transactions on this scale.
I want to talk about kind of the weirdness of these parallel investigations, right? The congressional ones, the Mueller probe, which they seem to play cards pretty close to their vest and not make a bunch of splashy announcements until they've got indictments, the Second District of New York. And then this Michael Avenatti and the Stormy Daniels case going on TV, making these explosive statements, releasing this information. I can't think of another case like this where you had that kind of back and forth between this weird public thing and then this official private thing.
Yeah, and I do worry that all of this public disclosure could compromise Mueller's investigation in some ways. Most investigations are very quiet. No one knows what you're doing. They don't even know that you're investigating anything. So you can do a lot of things without worrying that some of the subjects are being tipped off. People are not shredding documents or getting their stories straight or intimidating witnesses because they don't know that they're under investigation. When things are so public, it does worry me that it could in some ways jeopardize the investigation. But, this is a unique animal in that it is likely that Robert Mueller will follow DOJ guidance and not seek an indictment against the president if the evidence should get to that point, but instead make a recommendation in the form of a report for Congress to decide whether impeachment is an appropriate remedy. And so in many ways, it does become more of a political matter. And so all of these allegations out in the public arena could matter, because at the end of the day, it is politicians who would have to decide whether, you know, the president has committed impeachable offenses. And some of that will come from what they're hearing from their constituents.
Barbara, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Barbara McQuaid teaches at the University of Michigan Law School, was formerly U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. She joined us to talk about the current allegations against the president's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, and fees that he received from several clients. The number of people who have contracted diseases from ticks, mosquitoes, and flea bites has been steadily on the rise in recent years. That's according to a new report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The CDC says that since 2004, the agency has seen a number of new or uncommon illnesses showing up in the United States. Our next guest is an expert in tick and mosquito-borne illnesses. Lyric Bartholomew is an associate professor in the Department of Pathobiological Sciences in the School of Veterinary Medicine at UW-Madison. Lyric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
So these numbers out from CDC, I'm guessing not a big surprise to you?
That's right. Yeah, but it was great to get that acknowledgement that this is a real issue and it's on the rise.
And what kind of numbers, what kind of things are we seeing nationwide, first of all?
Yeah, so I think one of the most visible ones that people know really well is that Zika hit the United States a couple of years ago, and that made a big splash and put this on the radar for a lot of people. And here in Wisconsin, another one that people are very familiar with is Lyme disease. We have a lot of Lyme disease here in Wisconsin.
Let's look at each of those in turn. Let's start with Lyme, because that's the biggest factor,
sure.
I think, here in the state. People have been hearing about it, worrying about it, getting it for a while now. Are we seeing the kinds of ticks that carry Lyme disease getting into more and more new areas? And are we seeing Lyme infections carried by those ticks on the rise as well?
Yeah, I think both of those things are definitely happening. So if you were to look at where ticks were 20 years ago, it would have been much more focal in the western part of the state. And over the years, we've watched them progressively move farther and farther eastward in the state of Wisconsin. And as they creep across, the numbers of them that are infected is probably on the rise too.
And what is leading to their spread? Is it just ticks move, or are there climate issues, weather issues, human transportation issues that are letting them spread further and further?
Yeah, all of those things may play in. I mean, ticks can't go very far on their own, right? So they really rely on other hosts to carry them around, and white-tailed deer are one of their really important hosts that expand their range. Also, we're seeing, you know, as people are valuing outdoor spaces and natural spaces, that ticks can really readily move into places where there's just a few trees. And so if a deer moves there and the tick drops off, then the tick gets to a new spot.
Right. I think in the past we thought of Lyme disease and deer ticks as when you go into the woods, you got to watch out for this. Now it seems like more and more we're hearing when you go to that edge of your yard.
That's exactly right. And that's what we're seeing when we're out there looking for ticks out in various parts of Wisconsin too, that they really are showing up in people's backyards. We used to think of that as sort of an East Coast phenomenon, but it's happening right here now too.
If I did your job and thought about this all the time, I would worry that I would just kind of lock myself in a vault and never get outside. I'm assuming you haven't, because of your job, you can't do that. What kind of precautions do you take when you go out into either the wild or even on that edge of the yard?
Yeah, I love being outdoors, and there's so much value, as we know, in being out in open spaces. Right now, I'm really excited about going morel hunting this weekend. I wouldn't miss it. And so to keep myself safe, I use like an insect repellent and spray down the legs of my pants. Sometimes I'll tuck my pants into my socks and roll like that, as unfashionable as it seems. But my primary approach is to make sure and do tick checks when I get in. And another solid recommendation is that when you come in from a forested place or even your backyard, as we've just discussed, you could take a shower. And if a tick is just crawling around on you, a shower alone will probably wash a tick that's looking for a place to land off of your body. So you know, just cleaning up and then watching for ticks is my way.
And people have been talking about this for a long time. I'm still never quite clear. And I think in the moment I might panic. What is the best way to remove a tick that we find that's attached to
us? Yeah, thank you for asking. It's such an important thing because people will use all kinds of wild folk remedies to get ticks off of them. And the tried and true best way to do it is just get a pointy tweezers, grab the tick by its sort of face right where it's touching your skin, and slowly and deliberately pull it out.
Now, Lyme disease, bad enough in and of itself. I keep seeing news about different diseases being carried, sometimes by the same kind of ticks, sometimes I think by different ticks.
Yeah, and so there's been some really great work done on this campus by Dr. Susan Paskowitz and some collaborators at Mayo Clinic and other institutions, showing that the ticks have some interesting new pathogens that are a lot like the pathogen that causes Lyme disease. So we found two of those. We see another type of tick-borne disease called anaplasmosis on the rise as well. And so we are one of those states that manifests what the CDC was saying, and that there are a whole bunch of new pathogens being transmitted by these vectors.
I think people have heard a lot about Lyme disease. They now watch for the bullseye thing and some of the other symptoms. What kind of weird symptoms might be a sign, again, if we've known we've had a tick mm-hmm. contact or a possible one, what mm-hmm. kind of signs are like, get to that doctor now?
Yeah, I think if you're showing signs of having, you know, like a really terrible, strange midsummer fever and headache, those things that we often get when we have a bacterial infection, and you know that perhaps you've been out in places where there might be ticks, it's not a bad idea. We've also just recently started a service here at the UW where people could send us a tick. So if you've encountered a tick, we can let you know what kind of tick you've come into contact with. And that way you have some sense of what that risk might be. So if it's one of those ticks that transmits one of those pathogens and it's been on you for a while, so it's full of blood, that increases your risk.
Lyric Bartholomew is with us from UW-Madison talking about the diseases carried by ticks and mosquitoes. Let's spend a little time about mosquitoes. Yeah. Let me see if I have this right. I think there's a bad news, good news story. We're going to get mosquito bites living in Wisconsin. Good news, it doesn't seem like they're as prone to carry disease at this stage in Wisconsin history. Is that right?
So I think one thing that's probably less obvious and maybe not as many people have heard about it is that we continue to have an issue with West Nile virus in the state of Wisconsin. And last year we had a pretty extraordinary number of cases of some other types of mosquito-borne illness. And so I'm glad you asked, because there's some really important ones for people to know about. One of the mosquito-borne diseases we saw last year was a disease called Eastern Equine Encephalitis. That one infects horses and can also infect people, and it's really awful for elderly people in particular. And so that's we saw a number of cases in horses with that virus last year. We saw a number of cases of a sort of re-emerging virus called Jamestown Canyon, and we still have a threat of a virus called La Crosse over on the western part of the state, in particular a virus that impacts small children.
How common are those?
So last year, for example, it looks like the number of people that may have contracted and gotten really sick from Jamestown Canyon virus was around 50. And so the number of people is distressing, but really for those families, it's really hard because sometimes those diseases make people sick really for a long time.
Now, Zika, as you mentioned, that's one people have heard of. It was mm-hmm. in the headlines.
Yeah.
The kind of mosquito that can carry Zika, it's a particular kind of mosquito, and yes, sometimes they've been spotted here in the state.
Yeah, so I should say that the CDC granted us here at the University of Wisconsin a Center of Excellence Award for vector-borne diseases. So we're one of five regional centers across the U.S. That's working with the CDC to try and understand vector-borne diseases and control them. And as a
vector-borne
result...
Vector-borne meaning carried by other critters.
Right, thank you. So carried by some kind of bloodsucker, like a mosquito or a tick or a flea, as you mentioned. And so we had opportunity last year to, in a really concerted way, look for one of the mosquitoes that might be involved in transmission of Zika, and we found it for the first time in the state of Wisconsin and in some of the other partnering states that are involved in our Center of Excellence. But, you know, so that's something that we're keenly aware of and we're watching.
Okay, now my paranoia is going up again because it's hard to live in Wisconsin and not get any mosquito bites. I mean, we can spray up when we know we're going to be outside for a while, mm-hmm. but unless we're spraying up every time we go out to, I don't know, get the mail, we're going to get some bites.
We're going to get bites. I think it's still worth it to be outside, absolutely. And you can do some things in your own home to at least potentially reduce the number of mosquitoes you're contributing to the environment. So at your own home, I'd like for you to please go and empty any standing water. Maybe go clean out your gutters and have some control over it that way. I think knowledge is power, right? And so as long as you know about these things and you're taking proper precautions, absolutely be out there recreating.
Are there diseases or vectors, disease carriers that maybe aren't so much here yet, but they're on your radar, you're watching for them showing up in Wisconsin?
Yeah, and so the one that you mentioned, the one that could be involved in transmitting Zika, Aedes albopictus, we're keenly aware of that one coming into the state and trying to actually prevent it from being established, asking questions about whether it will establish or not. We're also looking at this tick, Amblyomma americanum, the Lone Star tick. That one has progressively creeped northward, and we're starting to see that one in Wisconsin too.
How does one stop a strain of mosquitoes from migrating into the state?
Yeah, good question. I think what we're seeing is that there could be kind of point sources that are associated with bringing those kinds of mosquitoes in. So if people transport water-containing things, even pots from one state to another that contain those mosquitoes. So watching for those point sources and controlling them as soon as we can.
And briefly, how are you monitoring? How do you monitor for a kind of mosquito or a kind of tick?
Yeah, thanks for asking that too. That's fun. So we have some really simple ways to look for, like, the mosquito that the Aedes albopictus, the Asian tiger mosquito. We put out a black plastic cup like you might get at the stadium. And we put a tongue depressor inside it with some water. And the mosquitoes are really attracted to water in a black cup. And they'll come and lay their eggs on the tongue depressor, send it back to me and Dr. Paskowitz's lab. And we can grow them up and see what's there.
High technology mosquito capture devices.
Absolutely.
Lyric, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lyric Bartholomew is an associate professor in the Department of Pathobiological Sciences in the School of Veterinary Medicine at UW-Madison. Been talking about the growing number of tick and mosquito-borne illnesses in the United States and how they're showing up and being tracked here in Wisconsin. PBS is launching a new series called The Great American Read later this month. The series celebrates the power of reading while focusing on America's 100 favorite novels. That list came from a poll of over 7,000 people from around the country. Only fiction was included, and authors were limited to one title or series on the list. The results include everything from classics like Wuthering Heights and Little Women to more recent favorites like Twilight and Jurassic Park. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite novel? What book do you find yourself going back to and rereading? What makes it special? If there were a list of your 100 favorite books, would it be filled with big-name classics, science fiction, romance, thrillers, mix of everything? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jonathan Segura is executive editor of Publishers Weekly and the author of the novel Occupational Hazards. His writing has appeared in GQ and Rolling Stone, the Paris Review Daily, and elsewhere. Johnny, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. A pleasure to be here.
Well, did you scroll through the list and spot some of your favorites on it?
You know, I got to say, not a lot of my personal favorites were on there. You know, I don't know if that says more about me or more about America, I suppose.
Well, what I think it may say, and I'm in the same boat, I think it says that novels are really personal, how we're going to react to them. And yeah, a lot of people may like the same things, but what I like might not be what you like.
Absolutely, absolutely. And one of the things that was really striking to me about the list is how sort of, I guess for lack of a better word, democratic it is, in that it's not all, you know, high art fiction. It's really a mix of popular fiction, of classics, of genres. There's science fiction on there. There's all sorts of books on there that I was really surprised to see, which is, you know, it's great. I mean, this is like a really, you know, wide, diverse reflection of you know, a huge country and what people are reading and what they love to read.
And the list was billed at one point as like America's most loved novels. And I look and see like novels like 1984 or The Invisible Man, important novels, really good novels. I don't feel like that loved, comforting feeling reading either of those, though. There's a lot of different ways to define what a good novel is or even what a novel we like is going to be.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, like to that end, you know, I mean, one of the books on here is you know, a book probably everybody read at some point. You know, it was assigned reading in either junior high or high school. You know, Where the Red Fern Grows. You know, a book that will absolutely make any, you know, sentient human being cry by the end. You know, sometimes you need a good cry, I guess, and that one will deliver. Yeah, no, it is really surprising that, you know, on the same list is that there's Jane Eyre, you know.
Mm-hmm. And you're, from your vantage point at Publishers Weekly, this project from PBS, I think, is designed to kind of boost our love of reading. In a high-tech age, are we still big readers? Do we still love our books, whether we're reading them on paper or on a screen?
Yeah, I think without question. You know, it's you know, we live in a time that is so driven by story and narrative, and whether you get that from fiction or nonfiction or just, you know, the way a lot of you know, news is reported these days. Things are a lot more narrative driven right now. And I think that's, you know, a sign that people, you know, obviously storytelling is such a fundamental part of humanity. And, you know, I don't think that's going away. I think probably, obviously, the distribution methods are changing, and where people read, whether it's on a Kindle or on a you know, tablet, or with a, you know, dog-eared, chewed-up old paperback. You know, I mean, I think the delivery method isn't as important as the fact that people are still reading and still, you know, loving their books.
One conflict I have sometimes, Johnny, and you can let me know if you're in the same boat. There's, you know, there's books I like. There's books that I'm going to have fun with and read. There's kind of that list of should reads over the years, whether they're old classics or new important novels. And sometimes when I get that mentality that, oh, I'm supposed to read this and appreciate it, that I don't know, it triggers some rebel part in my brain, and I push back on that. Do you ever contend with that?
Daily, my friend. Let me tell you, you know, I'll confess to you now, you know, one of the books on the PBS list is one of those for me. Moby Dick, never made it through.
Me neither.
I know I should. I need to read Moby Dick. I think I should need to read Moby Dick. never done it. I've plowed like, you know, a dozen or so pages into that thing. One day I'll come back at it.
You know, and kind of in
but there's no shame in it, though, either, I think. You know, there are so many books out there. If it's not doing it for you, put it down, pick up something else.
Exactly. And kind of on the other end of the spectrum, Stephen King is on there with The Stand, hugely popular writer. I never had a Stephen King reading phase. I've read short stories, and that's about it. And I feel a little guilty. Like, people love him. People I know and respect love Stephen King, and I haven't really read anything by him. Do you have authors in that sort of category?
You know, sort of, I guess. I have not dipped into any of the Knausgård novels, which are, you know, have a huge cult following. I think they're probably, you can't really call it cult anymore. It's just a giant following. and he's written a series of novels and arguably novels, or whether they're nonfiction or not, you know, it's part of the charm of them and their attraction. You know, and the hype and the adoration of these books around the author's biggest fans is sort of daunting to even begin to like dip your toe into it, given, you know, what scene you're walking into, sort of cold there.
We're talking about America's favorite novels. Jonathan Segura is with us, executive editor of Publishers Weekly. PBS, this PBS reading project, surveyed people, came up with 100 great novels, favorite novels that people like. And it's a huge variety, as we were saying. There's Stephen King, Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged, Lord of the Rings, some of the great, great Russian novels, Tolstoy and Dostoevsky are on there, Moby Dick on there, lots and lots of stuff. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If we surveyed you, what would be on your list? And how do you judge what you would put on that list? We'll go to our callers now. Kayla is with us in Milwaukee. Kayla, hi.
Hey.
What novel did you want to share with us?
My absolute favorite novel is The Princess Bride by William Goldman. I've lost track of how many times I've read it, actually.
And did you read it before the movies came out, or was it you saw the movie and then went to the book? Which order did it go for you?
I saw the movie when I was a kid, and then when I was in high school, I learned that it was a book. And so then I read the book, and hands down, the book is better, although the movie is a work of art as well.
Thank you so much for sharing that. Based in When My Lifespan Was, Jonathan, I did it the reverse order. I read the book because there wasn't the movie yet. Is that one that either you'd put on your personal list, or at least based on what other people are reading, you can see that being on this list?
I could definitely see it being on this list. It's you know, such a, you know, the movie especially, I think, opened that book up to such a vast audience that it wouldn't have had otherwise. And, you know, it's one of those books that, as the caller said, you know, you go back to and you read it over and over, and, you know, why do people do that? You know, is it because it's comforting? Is it because when you go back to it with, you know, later on in life with different experiences, the book sort of speaks to you in a different way? You know, all these are things that you know, are sort of reasons and speak to, you know, why books are as popular as they are and continue to be. And I'm rambling, so I'm going to cut myself off right here.
All right. Thanks for that call, Kayla. We'll go to Marge next in Milwaukee. Marge, hi.
Hi, how are you doing? Love it.
Good. What do you want to share with us?
The book is The Cowboy and the Cossack, like Russian Cossack. So, and the author is Claire Huffaker. And I don't think very many people have ever come across that book.
This is one I haven't heard of or read. What is it about this one that grabs you, Marge?
Oh, it's a really good read. I can see it being an excellent screenplay. It is about a group of cowboys who take a herd of longhorns across to Russia during the revolution, when the Tsar was, when there was Tartars and Tsars, uh-huh. And it is just such a good read.
Interesting. Marge, thanks a lot. That is one that was new to me. And Johnny, yeah, if you had to winnow down a list of your own 100, what kind of criteria would you use? A great, and that sounds like a great adventure story read. How much of that would there be versus classic type stuff?
For the stuff that for what I like to read, you know, I like, I do like a book with a plot in it. I like things to happen. You know, I mean, I'll pick up, you know, anything with Elmore Leonard's name on it. You know, but one of the things that I really like, and I find really attracted to a book the most is sort of on a line level, how the language works, how the sort of the tone, the feel of the sentences, of how the writer sort of chooses to convey their story on the most basic, you know, word level. So, you know, Elmore Leonard has a very distinctive voice. It's very clipped and fast and funny. I really, you know, on the other end of the spectrum, I love Martin Amis as well. He's an English writer, very, very, you know, high tenor. You know, I think line for line, you can't find the better writer working in the English language right now. And he's also super just savagely funny. And his books, you know, are often, you know, pretty dark, darkly comic, which is, you know, definitely in my wheelhouse.
Talking to Johnny Segura, executive editor of Publishers Weekly, talking about a new list of Americans' 100 favorite novels. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite novel? What do you love about it? Is there a book you'll always be able to go back to and reread? Do you go for the classics, new stuff, genre, important novels, however you want to define that? What makes a book, a novel, a great novel to you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. Right now, we're picking up the conversation about America's favorite novels. Johnny Segura is with us from Publishers Weekly, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite work of fiction? What makes it special to you? What kind of things do you look for? Do you go to classics, science fiction, romance, you name it? Tell us what you like in a novel. Tell us your favorite. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We have a link there, I believe, to a new list from PBS where they surveyed people, ended up with 100 novels on that list. Let's go back to your calls now. Ed is with us in Edgerton. Ed, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you got for us, Ed?
Without a doubt, my favorite novel is Watership Down by Richard Adams. It's a great quest story. It's the one with the rabbits and kind of reflects our society as a whole, I believe. And I've been reading it since junior high, and I pick it up every couple of years and reread it again. So,
thanks a lot, Ed. That is not on the 100 list. It's one I could see having ended up on it. I think that's a big one with a lot of people. Johnny, any thoughts on Watership Down?
Oh yeah, classic novel, widely loved, and it is when you know surprise. I mean, maybe not surprising not to see it on the list, but as you say, it definitely has all the makings of a book that would be just very well at home on this list.
Thanks a lot for the call. We go next to Erica with us in Arena. Erica, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your book, Erica?
My book is actually a series. It's the Bulgariad series by David Eddings.
So it's a fantasy series, right?
Yes. And I have read it probably 100 times in the last 10 years.
Wow. Literally, that's not an exaggeration?
That's not an exaggeration. I probably read the whole series in about a week. And
okay.
I probably do it 3 or 4 times a year.
And you've based your life on its teachings at this point?
No. It's just, it speaks to me.
All right. Erica, thank you so much. And I'm going to confess something to Erica. There is a category of books, I like fantasy books, that sit on my shelves. And I always think, I'm going to read that someday. And the first book of the Bulgariad, that is one of those books. And I got to pick it up now with Erica's recommendation. Johnny, do you have you're at Publishers Weekly. You must have stacks and stacks of books sitting around staring at you, demanding your attention.
We do. And every day, dozens more show up. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah, are there ones that are on that I got to read this someday list? They're sitting there, and you just haven't cracked them yet.
You know, I've got. Let me just push back and look at what's on my shelf right now.
you can probably weigh them.
Know, let's see. Here's a nonfiction book that probably doesn't really fit the discussion. It's a biography of Charles de Gaulle. Very exciting.
That sounds cool.
Let's see. I have probably half my shelf is. Is books that I would like to read at some point, and I won't get to. Here's one called The Mercy Seat, which is a book that I think is either just out or just about to come out from Grove, set in rural Louisiana in the 40s. It's supposed to be a very moving story. I read a review of it, and I picked it up with the intention to read it immediately, and here it is sitting on my shelf still.
You've got a lot of competition. Before we go back to our callers, I want to mention a lot of the books on this list have been adapted into film or television. We heard about Princess Bride earlier. Then there's Game of Thrones on the list, Color Purple, Charlotte's Web. Do you think that getting made into a movie or TV version gets that book more into the public eye, makes it more enduring in a way?
Oh, unquestionably. I think it opens any book to a much larger audience than it would have had before, you know, I mean, with the rare exception. You look at, like, you know, The Godfather, which is on the PBS list, you know. That was a popular book in its day. But you know, it's now a part of the American cultural firmament, you know, thanks to the film adaptations. Just coming up this weekend, I believe it is, Showtime's launching a new limited series adaptation of the Patrick Melrose novels by Edward St. Albin, which is getting a lot of buzz and attention. And those were books that were, you know, fairly popular before, and I think we're going to definitely see a giant uptick in the number of people reading them after this weekend when the adaptation on Showtime premieres.
And a fun fact, I'll have to double check this. I believe Godfather is the book that my mom was reading when she went into labor with me. So it plays an important part of my life, even though I haven't read it. back to our callers now, Teresa in Nisida. Hi.
Hi. I would choose Roots by Alex Haley.
Ooh, and is that one you've gone back to and reread?
Yes, I have. I was in eighth grade, and my brother knew how much I loved to read, and he got me the book for Christmas. And from that moment on, I was just buried away until it was over. And it had kind of a powerful influence on me. And, of course, that one also became a movie. But the book itself and the way it was written was so beautiful and so well done that, you know, you really could be right there with what he was writing, especially the slave ships. I remember most vividly those chapters about the slave ship and what it was like on them. You know, it educated a little girl. You know, it was amazing.
Theresa, thank you so much for sharing that one. Roots, not on the list. Seems like that one could easily have been Johnny. But I love the way she talked about images that stuck with her, you know, from reading it as a kid and then rereading it. A book that can really create that powerful, lasting image is a pretty good novel.
Oh, yeah. And that's, you know, one of the best things that you know, fiction can do, which is, you know, give you the sort of, you know, image, the feeling that, you know, you can't replicate that, you know, by watching a movie. The movie does the work for you. With fiction, you're doing the work for yourself, and some of these moments and these interactions or lines or scenes become sort of indelible in your own mind.
Theresa, thanks for sharing that with us. We'll go next to Fawn on the line in Sparta. Hi, Fawn.
Well, hi, how are you?
Good. What book do you want to share with us?
Our household favorite book is The Outsiders.
Ooh, that's a classic. I read that in junior high, I think it was. And so that's your household? Everybody in the house loves this one?
Yes. It was one of the things that we found, my husband and I, when we were dating, that we had in common. And then it was a book that, even though by the time our children were born, you know, the movie had definitely come out, but we had them read it. And I believe my daughter's read it a couple times now. My son's only read it once, but no, it's just one of those ones that you can relate to on so many different levels, you know, in society.
Fawn, thanks a lot for calling in with that one. And that's one that gets read, as I said, I read in junior high, and I have a very strong memory of our stern English teacher reading part of it out loud and crying. I won't spoil the scene, but crying when one of the main characters dies in the book and giving this whole new perspective on my, I'm going to say, eighth grade English teacher. Johnny, The Outsiders is on this list. No surprise there, I'm guessing.
No, not at all. I mean, it's a book that so many people have read. Largely, you know, for assigned reading, but you know, it, you know, that doesn't mean that everybody's, you know, that it, you know, people are going to like it.
There are
a lot of books that act as broccoli, you know, that they read because they must. And this is, I think, one of the books that's often part of assigned reading that sticks with people and they come back to it later in life, as the caller was saying.
Fawn, thanks. Time for one more caller. Marty is with us in Madison. Marty, hi.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Good. What book or books do you want to share with us?
Well, I grew up on Nickelodeon back when it was owned by the BBC, and so I kind of developed a very dry British sense of humor. I'm a big science fiction fantasy fan, and I fell in love with Terry Pratchett's Discworld series many, many years ago. And my library changes every so often, but all of his books have a very special reserved spot, and I will never lose those.
Marty, thank you so much for sharing that. Terry Pratchett, Discworld. That's another one where maybe you could say it's a cult following, but it's a lot bigger than that, the very popular books. Johnny, just in our last few minutes, if a poll like this got conducted, 100 best novels, say 50 years from now, do you think a lot of the things on it would stick around, or would you expect to see a lot of change?
You know, that's a really interesting question, and I would expect to see a good amount of change. There are a ton of great books coming out, or have come out in probably the last couple of years that haven't really had time to you know, sink deeply into the scene yet. I would not be surprised, you know, if you look at something like, you know, Marlon James's novel, A Brief History of Seven Killings, that came out. It was a few years ago. An immensely powerful novel, kind of hits everything right. It's big.
And we'll leave it there. Jonathan Segura was with us. Thanks to him, executive editor of Publishers Weekly and author of the novel Occupational Hazards, with us to break down a new list of Americans' 100 favorite novels. We talked about swearing yesterday on the show. We talked to the author of Swearing is Good for You. A lot of you called in and shared your stories, your opinions on swearing and how it fits into your life. And some of you joined in on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Wanted to share some of those that came in after the conversation we didn't get into in time. Kathleen said, I like to tell my husband that I know all the words and how to use them. He seems very taken aback when he hears him coming from his delicate little flower. Thanks for that, Kathleen. Sadie wrote, I like to swear it's like a pressure valve, which is a little of what our guest talked about yesterday, and a pain reliever, too, along the way. Lisa wrote, I generally fly a few F-bombs before even getting out of bed, mostly because it's too early and I don't want to get out of bed and do what I have to do. Just a few more minutes, please. Lisa goes on, you wouldn't even want to hear what comes out of my mouth once I hit traffic, but I generally keep it to those contexts. I'm quite respectful and G-rated, or at worst PG, when interfacing with others. And Chris wrote, I swear at my car a lot. It doesn't listen. Still time for you to join that conversation at the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.